Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and to my left is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. We have one case for oral argument today at 9 o'clock. It's my understanding that everyone has appeared and is ready to argue. And before we begin, I would ask the clerk to call the case. You may begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Peacock. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Eric Anderson, Aaron Garcia, Herman Torres, Iris Torres, Alum RB LLC, and RB Shields Me LLC. We're here because we believe the trial court erred in several ways when it issued the injunction in this case. But real briefly, because there are so many appellants in this case, I want to spend just a few minutes giving the court a factual background of the appellants and also the appellee. The appellee is a corporation that sells radiant barrier products, and Mr. Dan Russell is the president and owner of it. Around 2018-2019, Appley began to experience a financial downturn when it lost several million-dollar accounts. As a result of that downturn, Mr. Russell, the president of Appley, began telling all the employees around 2020, the end of 2020, beginning of 2021, that everyone was going to have to get a pay cut. Also, the testimony during trial revealed that the corporate culture at Appley is not good at all. Actually, on the stand before the trial court, Mr. Russell admitted that 2020 was a very bad year for him because he engaged in what he said was, quote, too much drinking and sex. So it wasn't a good culture. Now, also, what the evidence revealed is that Mr. Russell has been trying to sell Appley since 2012, and starting in 2016, he engaged Eric Anderson, Aaron Garcia, and Herman Torres, who were employees at the company. He engaged them and discussed about selling the company to them, and off and on between 2016 and actually a few days before this lawsuit was filed, discussions have been ongoing about selling the company. Now, Mr. Anderson, he was hired and started his employ with Appley in 2010, and he was the accountant for the corporation. He resigned in January of 2021 because he testified for three reasons. Because, of course, the corporate culture was bad. He said he was tired of Mr. Russell coming in when he did come in 2020, which wasn't very much. He would come in and he was hungover. It was very bad. Number two, he said he was resigning because of the pay cut. He didn't want to take a pay cut. And number three, he said in January of this year, he heard Mr. Russell make a derogatory comment about his Christian faith, which really upset him. So that was one of the...
Are any of the facts you're telling us defenses to... Are any of the facts you're telling us in any way defenses to the enforcement of the non-solicitation agreement, if one exists, or the trade secrets issues?
Sure, Your Honor. We can go right to that. I was just giving the court, and I was going to start with Garcia right now, and I was going to go to Garcia and then Herman Torres,
okay.
But
go
if
ahead,
the court
counsel.
Would prefer me to go right to that issue, I can do that if that's what the court wants to do. The first issue that I think that, well, the first issue that we have in where we believe the court erred is in the enjoinment of the solicitation of Appley's customers and suppliers. This court said in Heat Shrink Innovations LLC versus Medical Extrusion Technologies Texas, quote, in the absence of an enforceable agreement not to compete, An employer is not entitled to injunction preventing a former employee from soliciting the employer's clients. Now, part of the facts I was going to get into, but I'll mention it here, is only three of the six appellants here were ever employees of Appalee. Three were employees: Eric Anderson, Aaron Garcia, and Herman Torres. The other three were not. They never even had an employer-employee relationship with Appalee. The three who did, Garcia, Anderson, and Torres, Herman Torres, there was no evidence that there is a employment contract. Matter of fact, during the trial, the hearing, the injunction hearing, Appalee's trial counsel tried to introduce a document which they alleged was an employee agreement. It wasn't signed by anyone. It wasn't signed by Appalee, anyone, a representative of Appalee, and it wasn't signed by any of the appellants.
But wasn't there evidence that from a witness that said that they had signed such a contract and that they were all missing?
Right. That was Mr. Russell. Mm-hmm. He testified. Now, he didn't testify that he did not testify that he had any personal knowledge of it. He said that all employees sign it, but he didn't testify that he saw anyone sign a contract. And matter of fact, Your Honor, the trial court, over the objection of appellant's trial counsel, when we objected to that, the trial court said this, that it was admitting the document as a form, but the court said it wasn't making that next step, and that's the exact phrase that the court used. It wasn't making that next step that a enforceable agreement was ever entered into. So it just admitted the form. But other than, Your Honor, to answer your question, other than Mr. Russell saying that everyone signs a contract, there was no evidence that a contract was ever entered into with these three appellants.
Were they the only three contracts that were missing?
There was never any testimony that Appalee had any of the others. And matter of fact, the law which the trial court accepted was that in order to prove that a contract was entered into, even though the so-called employment agreements were missing, was by parole evidence using the clear and convincing standard. And that's what the trial court said, and there was case law on that was introduced to the trial court. But other than Mr. Russell saying that everyone signed it, there was no other evidence that those contracts were ever entered into. As the court knows, that's a restraint of trade. And when the court restrains trade, there's factors that a court has to consider: geographic scope, time duration, etc. That was never; those considerations were never made. Now, in Appalee's response, they say this: a former employee, even without a written contract, cannot use the former employer's confidential information or trade secrets for his own advantage to the detriment of his former employee. We agree with that. Matter of fact, Appalee asserts that to confuse the issue. The trial court issued two provisions in its injunction, one dealing with the solicitation and one dealing with the use and disclosure of confidential information. The use and disclosure provision of the injunction takes care of that. So the business interest of Appalee is protected by the injunction without the solicitation provision in the injunction. Matter of fact, going back to the heat shrink case, this court said this, a trial court abuses its discretion when it enjoins, quote, a far broader range of activity than is proper or necessary to protect the employer's interest and infringes upon an employer's right to compete. That's exactly what happened in this case.
What year was that?
That was, may I get the case? I think it was 2016. That was 2014.
Did this form have a non-solicitation agreement in it?
It did, Your Honor. The second, my time is quickly going, so I'm going to move on to the second issue. The second issue is the probable, imminent, and irreparable injury that the appellee had to prove to the court, which we don't believe the appellee did. Of course, this court, I know, is well aware that in order to get an injunction, the appellee has to, or the injunction applicant has to prove three things: a cause of action against the defendants, number two, a probable right to relief sought, and number three, a probable, imminent, and irreparable injury unless the injunction issues. The problem that appellee has is there is no evidence whatsoever in the record that appellee would be damaged. To confuse the issue, at trial, appellee's counsel argued because of these employment agreements, which there's no evidence that those were entered into, that there was a presumption of injury, and that's what was argued to the trial court under this court's the case Tranter, and it's cited in the brief. But as I've been arguing, there is no employment agreement, so there is no presumption of injury here. So therefore, the appellee at the trial court had to prove harm, and not just harm, immediate harm. All appellants testified that they do not have the customer list or the supplier list of appellee. They even testified that they went through their electronic devices to make sure that they didn't have any of that information. How can there be harm when they don't even have any of appellee's confidential information, such as customer lists and supplier lists? There is no evidence. In order to prove that, let me back up and say this. That Tranter case relates to a employment situation where there's a presumption of harm. The injunction was issued based upon TUTSA, Texas Uniform Trade Secret Act. This court has said in IAC Limited versus Bell Helicopter Textron that in a TUTSA case, there is a presumption of injury if the plaintiff proves at trial that the defendant is in possession of a trade secret and is in a position to use it. There was no evidence of that. While appellants testify they don't even have the confidential information, appellee never...
Did any of the appellants routinely have access to this information as they were performing their job duties?
They did. Yes, Your Honor. That's different, though. Once they left the employment of appellee, they don't have it anymore. So where's the immediate harm? Number one, where's the harm? Number two, where's the immediate harm? And this court, the trial court, cannot enjoin appellants when there's no immediate harm. So we believe the court erred. Now, in their brief, and even before the trial court, appellee tried to argue that, well, they were in possession of this stuff. When I say stuff, I'm talking about confidential information, while they were employed. Sure. But once they left in the employment, they don't have it. And matter of fact, if the court looks at the exhibits to the order, the injunction order, the customer list is hundreds and hundreds of customers. They don't have that stuff. They testified under oath that they don't. So where's the harm?
But is the trial court bound to believe that?
Well, I mean, the trial court can, I guess, believe whatever it wants to believe, but they testified under oath, and there was no evidence that appellee introduced otherwise. So the only evidence before the court was their testimony. There was no other evidence, and so I to answer Your Honor's question, I mean, I guess...
Not even circumstantial evidence?
They only made allegations. They made allegations. Matter of fact, and it wasn't even in their pleadings, when Mr. Russell got on the stand, he alleged that desks were stolen, that phones were stolen. None of that stuff was in their pleadings.
What about the testimony of Mr. Emmons, though? Didn't the trial court make it clear in her statements after hearing all the evidence that she was relying heavily on the testimony of Mr. Emmons?
Yes, Your Honor, she did. Interestingly, that testimony, from Mr. Emmons revealed that there was some confusion as to where one specific product was coming from. Now, the issue there was that Mr. Herman Torres had was providing a product to Mr. Emmons' company, and he did that while he was employed at Appley. Now, the product didn't ship until after he left the employment, and Mr. Emmons even testified that the product was late, and Mr. Herman Torres left Appley in the end of April. The product shipped sometime beginning of May, and Mr. Emmons testified that he had just gotten it a few days before the injunction hearing. The injunction hearing started May 25th, so there was a little bit of time there, delay. But that all occurred while Mr. Herman Torres was employed at Appley. I see my time is gone, so I'll sit back down.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. I think that Your Honors have looked at this in the correct way, and I would like to quote from IAC versus Bell Helicopter, which came from this court in 2005. When reviewing a decision to grant a injunction, we must view the evidence in the light most favorable to the trial court's order, indulging every reasonable inference in its favor, and determine whether the order was so arbitrary that it exceeds the bounds of reasonable discretion. Secondly, a trial court does not abuse its discretion if it bases its decision on conflicting evidence and evidence in the record reasonably supports the trial court's decision. What you just heard from the appellant's counsel was the way they want it to be, but it does not address the evidence before the trial court. The trial court had ample evidence that these former employees were competing against Innovative in its business while still employed by Innovative and continued to do so thereafter. And so I want to start off by addressing the appellate's argument. There were three issues that were raised in the opening brief. One was that there could not be a restriction on their on appellant's right to compete absent a non-competition agreement. And that's the consistent theme throughout the first issue. In the reply brief, the appellant raised something that was a little bit different, and they complained about Exhibit 2 not being supported by evidence and claimed no evidence supports the trial court's decision that the appellants were actually knew who the customers were. I submit to you that that's outside the scope of the original brief, and because of that, this court should not consider those issues to the extent it is different from what they raised in their initial brief. Of course, Texas Rule Appellate Procedure 38.3, as well as many cases, including the case that I believe that this panel sat on, Denton County, says that, you know, basically you cannot consider a point that is raised for the first time in a reply brief, and that just makes sense. But in addition to that, if you look at the actual record, three reporters record 188 to 197 is the discussion between the court and counsel after the close of the evidence. Counsel for the appellants argued that this court had not decided whether or not you could issue an injunction that just said, please just issue an order saying that you can't use our confidential information or contact our customers. He said that's not specific enough and that this court had not decided that issue. As a result, the trial court, decided that she would like to see a specific list. We were sent home to find out what that list was. We produced the list, attached it to the injunctive order, and there was no complaint thereafter that that list was not supported by evidence or was not part of the record. So I submit to you that the issue of whether or not Exhibit 2 or the exhibits with the customer list or is supported by evidence has been waived. Secondly, I'll go to the issue that was not addressed on appellant's argument, but the second ground for a reversal related to the injunction as to Iris Torres and her company, RB Shields Me. The evidence was that R.B. Shieldsmeen has sold product as recommended by Herman through his innovative contacts, and specifically with respect to 84 lumber. And the way this the evidence shows, and this is in our brief, but the evidence reflects that 84 lumber made it an order with Innovative. Herman called his wife and said, can you fill this order? She filled the order. Herman then left the company, and subsequently Herman said that this is the new address and listed R.B. Shieldsmeen. And then secondly, Ms. Torres sent an email to 84 Lumber saying this is where you should now direct the payment. I submit to you that's evidence. And also, Ms. Torres also admitted that during the time that she was with R.B. Shieldsmeen, that Herman Torres had referred her to certain customers, although she couldn't remember or identify the specific customers that occurred. The trial court's order just ordered that Ms. Torres could not solicit customers of Innovative based upon information provided to her or R.B. Shieldsmeen by Herman Torres, which customers are listed on Exhibit A. I submit to you that that is a specific instruction to her that she cannot rely on referrals from Herman Torres if they're on the list of Exhibit A. And that's as far as it needs to go. So the trial court's order with respect to Ms. Torres and R.B. Shieldsmeen is sufficiently specific under Rule 683 to withstand scrutiny. The last thing that was in the appellant's brief is the issue of whether or not probable and imminent harm was proved by Innovative in this case. So I think, Justice Basil, you're absolutely correct. Each one of these employees, the evidence shows, and it's in the record, that each one of these employees had access to all customer information, all supplier information, while employed at Innovative. And secondly, the question is whether Mr. Herman also had access to Innovative's customers through his cell phone, which he used to communicate with Innovative's customers, and he still has that phone. And it begrudgingly admitted at trial that he could still use that phone to contact others. Mr. Garcia would print daily sales reports and provide them to Mr. Russell that showed who was buying and who was doing it recently. confidential information is protected information, and Mr. Russell testified that about the harm that Innovative would suffer in the event these folks were allowed to continue using their customer information and their supplier information. Now, what does the evidence show with respect to the use and harm? Mr. Garcia admitted that New Age Laminators, a company in India, was a supplier to Innovative, that Innovative actually trained to make the radiant barriers that it used. Mr. Garcia admitted that he learned of New Age Laminators from his employment at Innovative, and that his new company orders the exact same product in the exact same manner from the exact same supplier. Second, the biggest customer of the defendants going forward was R.B. Shieldsmeen, that is Ms. Torres' business, who also ordered product from Innovative. Although under Innovative, it just showed up as RBS. They did not delineate who the owner was or anything like that. So Mr. Torres would receive a commission on sales that were made to his wife's company without revealing that it was his wife's company that was then in competition with Innovative. Secondly, 84 Lumber, the situation relating to 84 Lumber is covered at two reporters record 94 through 97. At that point in time, that's when Mr. Torres diverted a sale to his wife's company at the detriment of Innovative. Ms. Torres admitted that Herman referred customers to her and that she does not recall who they were. That's three reporters record 110. As you pointed out, Mr. Edmonds testified for as triangle radiant barrier, but what counsel for appellant said that, well, that was before Mr. Torres left and abated. Yet Mr. Edmonds clearly testified that when he received product, Mr. Torres did not tell him that he was not working for Innovative, and the product was shipped from Energy Shield USA, which is the new company that that the defendants created after this lawsuit was filed, or just as this lawsuit was filed, and testified that Allume transferred all of its assets to Energy Shield USA as part of this. So Mr. Edmonds' testimony is 3 Reporters Record 34 through 36, and it's very obvious that when they did receive the shipment, it came from Energy Shield USA, which is the company owned by the defendants. And that also he said that the payment situation, you couldn't tell who the payment was going to because it was basically an electronic transfer. Now, Mr. Garcia admitted in his testimony that he did send the product to Triangle Radiant Barrier, but that he did it before the court entered its trial court entered its injunction, or TRO. Is there some evidence that reasonably supports the trial court's injunction in this matter? That's really the question before this court. No other question predominates, because the issue of whether or not this court can issue, or the trial court could issue an injunction in the absence of a employment agreement that basically restrains them from competing or otherwise, the answer is yes. And in fact, the trial court's injunction in this case is based upon violations of the Texas Uniform Trade Secrets Act. It does not rely on the potential contracts that they entered into with Innovative. And the reason that it still is relevant that those contracts exist is because, of course, Innovative has to try to protect its trade secrets, which it did by having those contracts before them. In addition to having a employee manual that prohibited such use, in addition to the defendants admitting that with respect to using the company's information against them, that would make sense that somebody ought to do that. So the question then becomes, if you have a ground, that is, did the trial court have some evidence before it that it was that the customer information, supplier information, was trade secrets? Yes. Did the trial court have before it evidence that the defendants were using those trade secrets in their own business, both before they quit Innovative and after? Yes. And then the final question is, was there some proof that that Innovative would suffer imminent harm? And I want to turn to the IAC case again, because I believe that this controls the situation. Quote, when a defendant possesses trade secrets and is in position to use them, harm to the trade secret owner may be presumed. And that's at page 200. And so in this case, as Your Honors, clearly recognized, the defendants were exposed to all of Innovative's trade secrets as part of their employment. And they used those trade secrets while they were employed at Innovative and thereafter. And the two specific instances that we came to the court with were 84 Lumber and Triangle Radiant Barrier. Now, in the context of injunctive relief, you only have to go so far as to find a probable right of relief. Not that we proved it, not that the evidence won't change, because you presume that it might. The thing is, did we meet the test? And the answer is yes. And then the further, again, from IAC, the threatened disclosure of trade secrets constitutes irreparable injury as a matter of law. We have proved that there is a, or that the trial court could reasonably accept and believe that there was a imminent threat to Innovative's trade secrets by the defendant's use and subsequent benefit off of Innovative's trade secrets. And I just want to address this. Counsel indicated that, you know, there were only three people who were actually employees. That's a red herring. A loom was created by those three employees. Subsequently, then, two of the employees continued that business. The Energy Shield USA, of course, which is not part of the injunction but is now a party of the case, is again created by them. RB ShieldMe was a sole proprietorship in 2017, but then formed as an LLC in 2021. If a company acts only through their humans, then the humans are the ones that are basically in charge of Hen House. So they can't sit here and say that, well, nobody else was an employee, so they can still benefit off the employee's use of the trade secrets. That just doesn't make sense. So, Your Honors, I have nothing else to offer unless you have questions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just looking at the time.
She'll take care of it.
Okay, thank you.
She's in charge.
thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address a few things that opposing counsel mentioned. First off, this is the first time that I'm hearing about an imminent threat. It was not at the trial court. There was no discussion of it at the trial court. There is no discussion of it in their brief. Number one, there is absolutely no evidence at all that there is an imminent threat. Like I mentioned a little while ago, there's no evidence that appellants even have the customer list or supplier list. So I don't know where he's coming up with this, there's an imminent threat. The second thing is opposing counsel wants to talk about RB ShieldMe and Triangle Radiant Barrier that Mr. Emmons owns. That issue is a fiduciary duty issue. That's not what this injunction is based on. This injunction was based on TUTSA. They will have their right in court to make the argument that some of the appellants breached their fiduciary duty if we get that far in this trial. But for them to, they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're trying to say that this injunction is proper because there's been a breach of fiduciary duty, but the injunction is not based on the breach of fiduciary duty. It's based on TUTSA. And so because of that, in order for the court to correctly issue this injunction, it has to properly be based on TUTSA.
Plead there was a breach of fiduciary duty?
They did plead that, Your Honor, but that's not what the injunction is based on. The other thing that they bring up is I want to say this before I run out of time. One of the things that has been problematic from the beginning in this case is that Appellee continues to group all of the appellants together. And that's very problematic. And that was one of the reasons I was starting out my oral argument to give a brief factual background. These are all not working together. You've got Iris Torres. She has her own company, RB ShieldMe. She has no relationship to the other except for her husband, Herman Torres, which is also a party here. She has no relationship with the others. Then you have Aaron Garcia and Eric Anderson. They were working together in a loom. And then you have Herman Torres. He's working off on his own by himself. The injunction supposedly lists harm, but kind of groups everyone together and doesn't specify the harm to each party.
Is it required to?
Well, Your Honor, the injunction does have to provide harm. And so
does it have to specify as to each individual defendant?
Well, Your Honor, I think it does. The court can't make a broad sweeping allegation on it. Excuse me, not an allegation, but a broad sweeping pronouncement Because some of that doesn't apply. How would this court know what harm applies to what party if the court doesn't say? And so it's not fair to this court for a trial court to just make a brief, broad, sweeping pronouncement to six parties when some of the harm might be due to one party but not to another party. So that's problematic.
Or perhaps the trial court found the harm as to all.
But then it has to be supported by the evidence. And there's no evidence to support that all six, the harm results from all six. That's the law is that it has to be supported by the evidence. And it's cited in the brief that if the trial court issues an order that is not supported by the evidence, it's an abuse of discretion. The next thing, and I'm running out of time here, but the next thing they talk about Mr. Herman Torres's phone. Okay, and Justice Sutter, this goes to exactly what we were talking about just a moment ago. That's different. There may be harm in regard to that, but not to the others. Now, interestingly, Mr. Herman Torres testified that he doesn't have on his phone all the contact information. He only has the individuals that were contacting him, and he testified it was around 30% on his phone. All the others, there's no testimony that they have any of that information. And so we asked, I'm running out of time here, we asked that the court reverse this because there was no harm, therefore an injunction should have never been issued. If the court doesn't do that, we ask that the court strike the portions of the order that deal with the solicitation because there's no evidence to support that part of the order. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument. It's been helpful to us. Your case has now been submitted, and we are now in recess, and you're free to go. Thank you.